Scottish poet Robin Robertson, who's also known for his translations, especially of ancient Greek tales, has a day job as a London literary editor, so he has definite expectations of poetry.
It's a distillation of the very essence of something, with all the paraphernalia, the superstructure, the scaffolding, all that taken away. Nobody's interested in that. You've got to try and get to the nub of the thing as quickly and as powerfully as possible.
Listen to Robin Robertson, who has the distinction of winning in various years for different books Britain's Forward Poetry Prize in three different categories. Now, selected poems from his five books are gathered under one cover with the U.S. publication of Sailing the Forest. We'll hear from that today on New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where Robin Robertson was recorded while at Rockhurst University's 2015 Midwest Poets Series. He talks about his work with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart.
The way you've structured Sailing the Forest, which is your selected poems, you divide the books up in the table of contents, but in the actual body of the book, the poems just flow through all the books without any breaks. Was that your decision, or was it just a publisher and editor?
No, it was my decision, because I suspect we're all always trying to write the same poem and just trying to write it better each time, and we just have the one sensibility. So each individual piece is an angle or a fragment of that sensibility. And I've kept the poems broadly in chronological order according to the collections where they first appeared, but it's only of interest to bibliophiles when and where the original poems appeared. So they're all of one piece, yes.
Yes. And it's interesting, too, because some of the newer poems in the book deal a lot with the Greek god Dionysus. And you have that wonderful poem, The God Who Disappears, about Dionysus. I'm wondering about the appeal that he had for you. I know in that poem you have a line, he watched his body swim through other shapes. And that other shapes quality for a poet must have a great appeal, but is there anything else about that?
Well, Dionysus is, for me, the most attractive of all the gods in the Greek pantheon. He's the trickster god, the equivalent to the North American coyote or the Scandinavian Loki. He is a Protean figure, always transforming himself into other things, more Protean than Proteus, in fact. The most volatile of all the gods, the youngest god in the pantheon and the most intriguing, I think. So I've been following his progress and trying to write about him for quite a few years. And I just did a version of The Bacchae by Euripides, which he is the main character. So I went to a 5th century Alexandrian Greek poet called Nonnus, who wrote the longest surviving epic in the Greek language called the Dionysiaca, which is almost unreadable. It's a truly terrible piece of work. But the advantage is that buried in there are some stories about Dionysus which are not recorded anywhere else. And so I wanted to try and retell those stories in my own way. He's unusual because he was born of a god and a mortal, and he is a god who dies.
And he's the only god, I think, in Greek mythology who dies.
Yes.
Yes.
So there are interesting, I'm sure that the Christian church wouldn't approve of me drawing any parallels, but there you are. So this is the god who disappears. Born to a life of dying, the boy god's first death came when he could barely crawl. The budding horns just there, nudged among curls as he played on the floor with his toys, a knuckle bone, ball and spinning top, golden apples, a tuft of wool, and on his other side, the thunderbolts of Zeus. They entered the throne rooms dark, their round faces smeared with chalk into pale moons, and they slid forward, drawing their hungry knives. He saw them in the mirror, looming behind him in 100 reflections, and he watched his body swim through other shapes, a doubled-up ancient with a face of rain, a blank-eyed baby, downy youth. Then he saw the mane of a lion, jaws opening, the sinewed neck of a bridling horse, the darting tongue and poison fangs and coils stretching for the throat of one of the murderers. Then twisting to the leap of a tiger, the shouldering heavy-horned bull, and then suddenly the great bull shuddered to a stop, and they started slicing him to piecemeal. So many blades he could see in the mirror, working on the bull-shaped Dionysus. He followed his image into the glass and was soon split and scattered, divided up, diced into the universe. He spends his life dying. The god who comes, the god who disappears. Dismembered, he is resurrected. He is beside us, beside himself. Ghost of abandon and abandoning, he shatters us to make us whole.
That was Robin Robertson reading The God Who Disappears from his collection Sailing the Forest. I'm Robert Stewart, and this is New Letters on the Air. That poem gets to a number of qualities of your writing that I think are just amazing. One is the lyrical turns that happen in the imagery. He shatters us to make us whole, and that kind of sense of repetition. And certainly it's understandable the appeal that a god like Dionysus might have in telling stories. I interviewed a poet on New Letters on the Air, Dunya Mikhail, and she used a lot of Greek myth in her poems, but mainly she used it to disguise her political statements. Of course, she's an Iraqi poet and eventually had to move to the United States because of her particular political situation. But in a way, do you feel that you're using Dionysus or Greek myth to disguise anything? Or is it a way to tell stories that are bigger than maybe yourself?
Well, I think the Greek myths are ways of telling stories about things bigger than ourselves, and that's why they've lasted for so long. All myths are basic archetypes and share a lot of similarities. North American, Indian myth, Norse myth, New Zealand, Maori myth, they're all the same. The names change, but the basic stories are the same. Yeah. So mythology is a way of tapping into something very important that sometimes we lose track of. I've enjoyed translating particularly Ovid because his great work, The Metamorphoses, is a retelling in itself of Greek literature in Latin, but all through the focus of transformation, turning into and turning away from. And that sense of movement and volatility and tension seem to me all crucial to art because their opposites, paralysis and stasis, are anathema to me and to most people I care about.
One of the other things that I've read about you is that you don't really like to discuss any kind of autobiographical elements in your poems. I mean, they do come into the poems, but they're not there for their own sake, I suppose, is what you might have said.
Yes, I wouldn't. I possibly would have said that. I do resist this seeming need in readers to decode poems as autobiographical sketches. Of course, all writing comes from some kind of a personal experience, but it's sieved through various filters over the years and emerges almost unrecognizable at the other end. There are a handful of poems that are straightforward in their biographical nature, but most of them have suffered a sea change over the years. And you could look through my books, and if you decided they were autobiographical, I would be all sorts of things. I would be a woman, I would be a Swedish playwright called Strindberg, I would be Dionysus, I would be this, that, and the other. I perhaps like to inhabit forms in the way that Dionysus does.
Oh, very good, yeah. And I also want to talk to you a little bit about the Scottish lyrical tradition and your relationship to that. You have a wonderful poem in here to Hugh McDermott. When I read that poem, I just thought, it almost made me fall over because it's so funny. And maybe you didn't intend it to be funny, but I found it to be really humorous.
I admire McDermott's work. We never had an occasion to meet. He was a difficult, complicated man by all accounts, not blessed with an easy sensuality. So I imagine that if we had met, it would have been excruciating. He was not blessed with a sense of humor.
Oh, okay. Well, now I just want to touch on the fact of humor in your poems, because many critics that I've read talk a lot about your poems being fairly dark. And as the poem that you read earlier about Dionysus, some violence to the imagery. But one of the things that I noticed in your poems, and especially like this one to Hugh McDermott, is there's a lot of very subtle kind of humor in there. And I have this theory that I've said, not about you necessarily, but I said that I like to think that all great art is funny, ultimately. And what I mean by that is that there's an element of wit to it. And I want to actually touch on that as we go through some of your other poems. But before I do that, it's a very short poem, and I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading it.
I'd be glad to. I'm not sure he'd be glad to hear it, but happily he's dead. The Tweed. Giving a back rub to Hugh McDermott, I felt, through the tweed, so much tension in that determined neck, those little bony shoulders, that when it was released, he simply stood up and fell over.
Robin Robertson reading his poem to Hugh McDermott, The Tweed, from Sailing the Forest. You're listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Robert Stewart. Hugh McDermott is kind of a turning point in Scottish literature in terms of Scottish modernism, that he ushered in the modernist movement in Scotland. Does that make sense to you?
Well, he would love to hear that. He did write some extraordinary poems, but he wasn't as profound a figure as, say, David Jones or Basil Bunting, or who are less known, Eliot Pound. Hugh McDermott was too political to be a truly great poet sometimes. And, you know, I have various quarrels with him politically and artistically. But he did write a handful of extraordinary things.
But is there any particular distinction in terms of Scottish modernism versus other modernism in Western poetry?
Well, as usual, we in Scotland, we receive culture about 10 years later than everybody else, so we were a bit slow to pick it up. And modernism tended to thrive in large international cities, Paris and London in particular. And Edinburgh and Glasgow don't really fit that bill. So modernism filtered through very slowly. And it doesn't quite suit the temperament of, or certainly of many of the Scots poets that were writing at that time, Edwin Muir particularly. And, you know, Scotland is a very small, fractured country. And even now, all the poets that represent Scotland are spread out right across from Edinburgh through to Shetland and Orkney and the Western Isles.
Well, while we're talking about early influences, there was a teacher I read that was pretty influential to you, Alistair MacLeod.
Yes. Well, I did my master's in Canada, and I was doing creative writing and English degree, an MA, studying with Alistair MacLeod, who recently died. He was one of the great short story writers of the post-war years. And I'm not sure he was an influence, maybe come to appreciate his work much more in my latter years. But he was a terrific teacher, and I rather terrifyingly had to take some of his classes, which go down in the annals of academia as some of the worst pieces of teaching that have ever occurred, because I was used to the domine system of lecturing. So you prepare a perfectly modulated 55-minute lecture. And in my case, my first lecture was on Araby, the story by Joyce from Dubliners. And it was about 18 pages long, my lecture. And I got as far as the second paragraph when somebody put up their hand, and I couldn't believe that they wanted to go to the toilet. Of course, they didn't. They wanted to ask a question, and they all continued to ask questions. And I didn't get to the end of the first page, and I was furious. So that ended my academic career.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I can relate to that. But I read that Alistair MacLeod wrote in longhand and he polished each sentence before he proceeded. I also read that of Dylan Thomas. There's this particular approach to writing sometimes, and I'm wondering about your own creative process. You know, if you'd say a word about how you work.
Well, I don't write every day. I write very seldom. And I store things up, as most writers do, in notebook form. And some of those words, images, phrases can go back 20 years, and they're just sort of waiting in this anteroom in my subconscious for a connection, a kind of live connection with something that I'm interested in now in the present. And so when I do get a chance to sit down, the mind will free up and I will start to see these connections tentatively made, some with very old material, some with quite recent material, but whatever is in my head at the time. And these images and words start to magnetically attract to one another, and the poem just seems to build, really, beyond my control. I just sit and watch it. The process is very much like dreaming, in that dreams attend to our buried desires and dreads, much in the same way as creative art does. And this is a way of releasing and dealing with these problems. And I see it in those terms.
The other thing is you travel an awful lot. And so you're maybe on the move a lot more than a lot of other writers would be.
Well, certainly on the move a lot more than Dylan Thomas was, who just seemed to go from one pub to another. And I also have a 9-to-5, 5-day-a-week job.
I wanted to also ask you about your career in publishing and how that has affected you as a writer. I know I have a career in publishing as well, and so I'm kind of curious about how that works for other poets. So what's been your experience?
Well, if I could advise all your younger listeners, if you are writing, don't go into publishing, and probably don't go into academia, come to that. It's difficult because if you're working at close quarters with text during the day, the last thing you really want to do, or last thing you really can do in the evening, is to turn your mind to your own writing, because you have too many other voices in your head. If you've been doing your job properly and in deep editing and deconstruction of text, your mind is somebody else's. So that has been an impediment. I mean, I enjoy my job and working with the 50, 60 authors I look after. But it takes me a couple of weeks to detox from them and their creativity and try and turn my mind to my own. So I tend to go off on, if I can, 5 or 6 weeks sabbatical. So the first fortnight is getting London and the city and these other writers out of my head, and then I start to free up.
Yes, and that does account for the fact that you've lived and traveled to lots of places all over the world, Greece and Sicily, I understand you were in.
Spent a lot of time in Italy. Yeah.
In Italy, mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there any particular poem that you, I mean, there are so many here that I have this whole list and we can't possibly do it.
Well, I haven't read a love poem. So this is a sonnet. It's about trying to stay in the sun for as long as possible on a summer's day, just moving around the bay. Poem that's trying to stay out of the shadows. It's called Abandon. That moment when the sun ignites the valley and picks out every bud that's greened that afternoon, when birds spill from the trees like shaken sheets, that sudden loosening into beauty, the want in her eyes fleet blue, the medals of light on water, the way the water intrigued about her feet, the ocean walking her out into its depth, sea lighting the length of her from the narrow waist to the weight of the breasts, the way she lifted her eyes to me and handed me back, simplified, that moment at the end, knowing the one I had abandoned was myself, edging with the sun around the bay's scoop of rock, locks, rolling the last gold round the glass. That shelving love, as the sun was lost to us, and the sky bruised, and the stones grew cold as the shells on the beach at Naxos.
Robin Robertson reading the poem Abandoned from Sailing the Forest. I'm Robert Stewart, and this is New Letters on the Air. I just love the way it ends with the location, just like that. And it just kind of like brings you right down to that moment. It seems to me that one of the things about your poems is that no matter what the subject matter, the language transforms it into a kind of celebration of whatever it is. And that's what makes the poems so uplifting for me, no matter whether I know where I am or not sometimes. Mm-hmm. You have a poem, Park Drunk. Some of the language in that poem is very precise, and yet they're unusual words. And this happens a lot in your poems. Maybe they're unusual words because I'm not familiar with your part of the world, but the diction, the language, the word choice that appears. Those words like craquelure.
Craquelure is just a term, a porcelain term for the varnish cracking up, which you see on certain glazes.
And even the snow has furred to silence, which the image itself is clear enough, but it's such an unusual verb. And if you wouldn't mind, go ahead and read that mm-hmm. poem.
This is firmly non-autobiographical, I want to stress, so that I will be invited back to the States. It's about a drunk, and this is set on the first day of a new year, probably in the northwest of Ireland. Drunks get a very bad press, and this is an alcoholic who is really watching, really looking at his environment and the life that he's lived and the life that he's lost. The park drunk. He opens his eyes to a hard frost. The morning's soft amnesia of snow. The thorned stems of gorse are starred crystal, each bud like a candied fruit, its yellow picked out and lit by the low pulse of blood orange riding in the eastern trees. What the snow has furred to silence, uniformity, frost amplifies, makes singular, giving every form a sound, an edge, as if frost wants to know what snow tries to forget. And so he drinks for winter, for the coming year, to open all the beautiful tiny doors in their craquelure of frost, and he drinks like the snow falling, trying to close the biggest door of all.
That was Robin Robertson reading The Park Drunk from Sailing the Forest. Once again, as you're in publishing and you're in editing, maybe you've noticed this, but a lot of times writers need to reach for language that isn't just the conventional language. And I see that happening through so much of your writing with not just strong active verbs, but diction that comes out of a different place that maybe surprises the reader just a little bit and stops the reader, which, you know, it reminds me a little bit of some poems by Wordsworth in which he will introduce a word in a very ordinary poem. He'll introduce the word diurnal, for mm-hmm. example, and just all of a sudden this word just kind of elevates it. And I see that so much happening in your own writing. It's really, really wonderful to read that in a poem. Your poems seem well-crafted in the sense that everything is taken out that shouldn't be there, that there's a great sense of understatement, even in terribly weighty circumstances. You have a poem called A&E, for example, about a heart operation. And I think that one of the things that strikes me about that particular poem is the restraint that comes at the end of the poem, that there's no attempt to over-dramatize the poem. And I think that's a great quality. It's something of a rare quality among writers. I think that the impulse is to tell a lot more than you have to, your impulse is the opposite.
That's the whole point of poetry. It's a distillation of the very essence of something with all the paraphernalia, the superstructure, the scaffolding, all that taken away. Nobody's interested in that. You've got to try and get to the nub of the thing as quickly and as powerfully as possible. And as you say, not to be freighted down by unnecessary ballast. Although it's got to have clarity. You can't take everything away, but you've got to allow it to move forward deftly and cleanly and elegantly, one hopes, and deal with the matter at hand.
That poem has that moment in it, I can't get that out of my mind, where the nurse, the triage nurse, is waving you away. And it isn't overtly funny, but there's something inherently contrary about it that does add another level of sort of humor or wit to the experience.
Well, for American listeners, that hospital, King's Hospital in Camberwell, is pretty much a kind of battle zone. It's near Brixton on a Saturday night. If you don't have an axe embedded in your head, then they're not interested. You know, you've got to be pretty well down and out. So somebody walking in calmly in a straight line wasn't of any interest to them. So I had to show them what I had going on underneath.
Oh, okay. I see. That's great. I wonder if we could hear that poem, A&E.
One of the threads that run through this selected poems is stories of this heart operation I had, which went wrong all the time for years after. It was terrific. So I got an awful lot of material out of it. And this is about a post-op hemorrhage, just to show you that even heart surgery has its funny side. A and E. It was like wetting the bed, waking up that night, soaked through. My sutures open again and the chest wound hemorrhaging. Pulling on jeans and an overcoat, I called a car to Camberwell and in through the shivering rubber doors presented myself at that Saturday night abattoir of casualty at King's on Denmark Hill. At the front line, behind her desk and barred window, the triage nurse was already waving me away till I parted the tweed to show her what I had going on underneath. Unfashionable, but striking nonetheless. My chest undone like some rare waistcoat, with that lace-up front, a black échelle, its red wet-look leatherette, those fancy flapping lapels.
A and E, from the book Sailing the Forest, selected poems by Robin Robertson, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He talked with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart while at Rockhurst University's 2015 Midwest Poet Series. Listen for part two of this conversation to hear about the influence of the Scottish landscape and his northern hometown of Aberdeen in an upcoming program. But if you can't wait, his interview is printed in the summer 2016 issue of the magazine. Look for our summer subscription special on our website, newletters.org. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Jamie Walsh, Renita Johnson, Morgan Hudson, Cameron Morse, Anders Carlson, Abby Jamison, and Nick Shea. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.